This is Ken Hollings, and this is Hollingsville. Welcome, traveller, welcome indeed, to Hollingsville, where people find themselves unexpectedly transformed into giant hats. In this series, my guests and I are going on an uncharted stroll through the world of tomorrow, tripping from pavilion to pavilion, examining our changing relationship with technology. The theme of our show today is Events, the Birth of Chance. And joining me at the karaoke bar, having brought their own sheet music and costume changes with them, are artist and filmmaker Tai Shani and the esteemed public presence and national treasure, Richard Strange. There is indeed nothing more serious-minded than an entertainer. Look at the way they just burst into tears whenever a camera is placed upon them. These are indeed serious-minded people. Musical interludes and background moods for this evening's episode are courtesy of the Hollingsville composer-in-residence, Graham Massey. Events tend to exist separate from the processes that create our history. They are framed by them, but they exist outside them. Events, dear boy, events tend to cause quite a lot of havoc, if only because they are very hard to measure. The durations involved in an event are hard to gauge, hard to plot in any specific way. Sometimes they involve periods of time that can stretch on for centuries, even millennia. I'm thinking particularly of the time when I was sent to West Germany to visit Karlheinz Stockhausen in his lonely retreat outside Cologne. And one of the things that we were talking about, and I particularly wanted to ask him about, was his experiences at the 1970 Osaka World's Fair. This I found particularly interesting because he was given this venue by the West German government of the time. It was a form of geodesic dome based on Fuller's principles, but not actually designed by Fuller. And it wasn't the sort of traditional kind of half or three-quarter dome. It was almost a complete sphere in which audiences would experience Stockhausen's electronic sound projections in the round, in every sense of the word. A very sophisticated speaker system had been installed. And I was asking him whether it corresponded to any notion that he had of an ideal performance venue for his music. And he said that it got very close and that he'd even explored the idea of bringing this dome back to Germany as a permanent concert hall. But unfortunately, while he could find the money to get it across the oceans back to Germany, he couldn't actually find a grant to maintain it, so the piece was finally dismantled. Which prompted me to remark that there's something incredibly tragic about these world fairs in which these enormous architectural projects are created, knowing that the majority of them are going to be destroyed, are going to be dismantled at the end of it. Stockhausen said he wasn't particularly worried about this position, this tragic notion, because he said, well, one day a comet is going to hit the Earth, everything will be destroyed, but, you know, we'll just go somewhere else and start again. In a weird way, I found that quite a comforting thought. But for those of you who like your optimism to be just a little bit more positive-minded, it's worth remembering that at the end of the 1939 World's Fair in Flushing Meadow, Westinghouse, the electrical corporation responsible for the Pavilion for Electric Living, buried a time capsule with memories of the fair, not to be opened or dug up, for 5,000 years. So there is a time capsule waiting to be opened in the year 6939. And there's more. In the 1964 World's Fair, which was also held in Flushing Meadow, New York, Westinghouse buried another time capsule, which was also to be opened in the year 6939. I have to admire their consistency in their position. I like that very much. And yet, the pavilions are dismantled, they disappear. The bits that remain almost stand there as a kind of, oh, what is the word, almost a rebuke to the moment itself. The little bits that exist, the Royal Festival Hall, the Nucleon in Belgium, the World Globe from the 64 World's Fair, even what remains of the parachute drop, a ride at the 39 World's Fair that ended up at Coney Island, where it now stays forlorn, unused, and useless, really. It's just a wonderful kind of antennae on the coast looking out towards the Atlantic. Probably one of the most famous sort of lost spaces, one of the ones that people get particularly nostalgic and blurry-eyed over, is the Philips Pavilion at the 1958 Brussels World's Fair, designed by Yanis Xenakis, the composer and mathematician, designed to house a concept by Le Corbusier, the poem Electronique, which was going to be a kind of media event within this wonderful futuristic space, which would include films, slide projections, coloured lights, and an electronic score by Varese. Now, this isn't really the time to talk once again about the score or the event itself. Other people have done this and better than me in other places. The reason I bring it up is that I'm fascinated by how this coordinated event came into being. The real kind of fascination for me for this in this event is not the architecture, it's not the visuals, it's the fact that magnetic tape is being used to generate a sound work which is to be relayed over something like 500 individual speakers. In some ways, it is the precursor to the Osaka Dome, where Stockhausen's work was performed. And in a sense, it uses a similar organizing principle. Poem Electronique is created on magnetic tape at the Philips National Laboratory. It involves a rather complicated playback system in which 9 machines are played back simultaneously in order just to produce one small piece of music. It's a 3-head machine, but most importantly, we have the tape. The tape is a response, a technical response to a fascination that had been developing in the modernist mind with simultaneity, dynamism, the instantaneous in every sense of the word, the unexpected. If we go back to the beginning of the 20th century, we look at how the futurists embraced the variety theatre, you know, the musical acts, the juggling, the acrobatics, the songs, the comedy, as being a new model for theatre that was faster, more dynamic, got rid of the musty language of the past and replaced it with gestures and colours and lights. Or indeed how the Dadaists embraced the notion of the cabaret in Cabaret Voltaire, where you'd have poems read simultaneously with each other. You'd have events happening at the same time in the same space, paintings on the walls, declamations, insults, etc. Carry on through to Jean Cocteau and Les Six being fascinated by the circus, by the Parisian boulevard sideshow. Further still, the surrealists stumbling from one cinema to another as they follow different silent movie serials in a kind of narrative delirium. The problem is actually coordinating all of these things, synchronizing them. They very rapidly spin out of control. Probably the best futurist piece of theatre was a Synthesi, as it was called, which involved the firing of a pistol across the stage. The play lasted as long as it took the bullet to go from one side of the stage to the next. I would think once you've pulled the trigger, the event is out of your hands, in every sense of the word. And I also think about Georges Antheil, the self-styled futurist composer who created the score for Ballet Mécanique. The original idea for this was to use percussion, sirens, and player pianos. He said he wanted a piece of music that had no love, no feeling, no emotion to it at all. I think perhaps that psychological element is important as well. But what's interesting is he couldn't actually get the player pianos to work together. You know, they constantly went out of sync with each other. So the magnetic tape somehow brings these elements into a controllable form. Time is suddenly rendered plastic. You can measure it with a ruler. You can cut it, you can rearrange it, you can run it backwards, you can run it at different speeds. Magnetic tape also brings in, you know, the twin deities of the microphone and the loudspeaker and the amplifier that brings them all together. With the amplification of sound, duration itself becomes more plastic. Sounds last longer or can be further away than they ever were before, but still audible. And in a weird kind of way, Varese was there at the end of it, but he never quite grasped the possibilities that that offered. I don't think that was because of a lack of vision on his part. I think it was because he still saw music in terms of something that had to be controlled. He liked tape because he didn't like conductors and he didn't like performers. They took liberties with his work. Tape did not. There was, at the 1958 Brussels World Fair, one person who I think did know how to respond to what tape could teach, what tape could offer as a possibility. And that was the American composer John Cage. He'd come to Brussels to give a talk called Indeterminacy. It had a wonderful subtitle. It was called New Aspects of Form in Instrumental and Electronic Music. This talk actually was not really a lecture. It was a reading, and it wasn't really about electronic or instrumental music at all. It was actually a series of stories, anecdotes that he'd collected over the years, told to him by friends or involving friends or people he knew or knew had heard of. What made the reading really interesting was that every single story had to take place within 1 minute of the watch. So depending on the number of words that the story contained, they were read at varying tempi. So more words you had, faster you had to read it. And there's a kind of simple elegance to that approach. Very, very simple, and yet it also has the genius of as it were, transforming the machine into a process which can be imposed. Cage isn't worried about control. He's actually giving it away. He's not worried about everything being in sync. Why? Because he has now seen that music as an event is something that occurs only in the realm of duration. There's a moment in 1948, he gives a talk at Black Mountain College, this wonderful summer retreat for artists and students. And in 1948, they had actually set aside part of the summer's events for a celebration of the work of Erik Satie. And Cage gave a talk in which he praised Satie very highly. But that wasn't enough. He actually also damned Beethoven. He actually talked about Beethoven deadening the art of music. Beethoven was in error, he says, and his influence, which has been extensive as it is, lamentable. Which is a credible thing to say when you've got people like Joseph Albers and Walter Gropius in the audience. Why does he despise Beethoven or consider him to be an injurious figure? It's because with Beethoven, he says, the parts of a composition were defined by harmony. With Satie and Webern, they were defined by means of time length. The question of structure is so basic, and it is so important to be in agreement with it. Duration controls everything in a way that harmony does not. In duration, suddenly you can introduce silence into your composition. If you're looking only at duration, issues of simultaneity no longer appear. They are just events happening in time and space at the same time. This, if you like, leads directly to an event in 1963 where Cage stages the first performance of Satie's Vexations. Vexations is a piano piece which involves a few bars of music with the instruction to be repeated 840 times. This takes over 18 hours to complete the entire work. Curiously enough, Vexations was only discovered the year after Cage gave his talk praising Satie and damning Beethoven. So it seems appropriate that he now stages this piece in its entirety. At the end of it, Cage describes how the world seemed completely new to him when he recovered from the moment of actually spending 18 hours with this piece of music. The world suddenly seemed different. And I think it's because he'd finally completely and utterly done away with any other consideration but duration as an organizing principle. We see it in his collaborations with the choreographer Merce Cunningham, where all they're interested in the end is the fact that dance and music occur in the same time frame. By the end, their collaborations are really just based on stopwatch settings. Even the involvement of costume designers, painters, other performers, etc., were brought together at the last minute, and they were all created independently of each other. Suddenly, anything's possible within this space, and I think what makes Cage's contribution so important, so exciting, is that, if you like, he's taken the questions of simultaneity, of the instantaneous, and completely stripped away all the kind of pop cultural trappings that it had. So he's got rid of the variety theatre, he's got rid of cabaret, he's got rid of cinema, he's got rid of entertainment in any sense of the word, and you're just left with the event itself, pure and simple. And in this, he says, this brings up a new situation for dancers. Theatre takes place all the time, wherever one is, and art simply facilitates persuading one of this. In a sense, chance develops out of this attitude towards music, and it takes the form of text, of language. What I am calling poetry, he said, is often called content. I myself have called it form. It is the continuity of a piece of music. Continuity today, when it is necessary, is a demonstration of disinterestedness. That is, it is proof that our delight lies in not possessing anything. And I kind of want to leave this section of the show by referring us back to Plato's Republic, probably the first ever World's Fair to be planned out, and certainly, you know, the first one to have such an in-depth guide to the attractions. And we have to remember what Plato's attitude towards the poet was. First, he is honored, he's celebrated, and then he is told to get the hell out of here, because there's nothing else you want messing up your neatly ordered showroom than a poet and the chance and the randomness and the events that they are capable of creating. And now I think it's time for a musical interlude from Graham Massey.
Thank you.
This is Ken Hollings, and this is Hollingsville. And you've just been listening to our first musical interlude in the episode. That was from our composer in residence, Graham Massey, and it was called Doublet Panther Stereo. And I have absolutely no idea what he means by that. We've been talking about events duration, but I think in introducing my first guest, Tai Shani, I should really start talking about time travel. Because while a couple of weeks ago, Julian House and I were on this on Hollingsville discussing dreams, particularly in relation to Salvador Dali's Dream of Venus Pavilion at the 39 World's Fair. Turns out that Tai was actually in New York, actually scouring Flushing Meadow in search of signs and portents of the pavilion itself. What did you find, Tai?
Sadly, I found a parking lot where the pavilion stood and a few little relics, as you said earlier, that have remained that are quite... they definitely still have that absolute adoration for the future and this kind of humanity to them. There are all these beautiful young men and women reaching for the stars, and you have the Unisphere, of course, that's still there. But you also have the 1939 New York Pavilion, which is now the Queens Museum.
Oh, right. Okay.
Which houses a museum now and also houses a panorama that was done for the 1964 one of all of the boroughs of Greater New York. But more interestingly is the Queens Museum of Art also hold the archive of the Dali pavilion.
Wow.
And they have some quite beautiful and rare things, such as the original album of the soundtrack that was used in the actual pavilion. And it's all, of course, boxed and archived, and you have to wear gloves to touch everything. But they have some really, really amazing... little things that they've kept, like napkins that he wrote alternative names for the pavilion for, and just, I guess, this kind of ephemera from his hotel and all these kind of things. So, yeah. But the park itself, unfortunately, it was really, really rainy on the day I was there, and it was quite scary to walk around, actually. But I did some filming of where it stood.
I get the impression, I mean, just from the accounts that I've read, that, I mean, the pavilion was actually in the amusement zone.
Yes,
so it wasn't
right.
Really part of the grand cultural order of the fair, such as it was. And I get the impression it was quite a seedy area to begin with.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it was all an excuse to show women very scantily dressed. I mean, the other kind of attractions were the sun worshippers, which were basically scantily clad women sunbathing that you could look at them. A woman being frozen alive, thus she had to be wearing a bikini as well. And the Living magazine covers, which also were basically semi-dressed women.
So it was, you know, we are in the slums of the future here, really, aren't
absolutely,
we?
Absolutely, yeah.
And I find it, I personally, I share your fascination with the Dream of Venus. I think for some reason I find it a really, it's a moment I go back to, because I think, see, I was right about catching up with buildings. I think of them as being like magazines or books or films. You maybe don't get them the first time around. They just exist on a slightly different timescale. Mm. And the Dream of Venus, it lasted about a year, didn't it? It was plaster of Paris, but it started out as a kind of surrealist girly show, and then it ended as a girly show.
Mm-hmm.
I think at the end it was called 20,000 Legs Under the Sea.
Yeah, that's right.
But you actually want to sort of raise it like Atlantis itself out of its obscurity.
By the way, the Queen's Museum also did an installation of it in 2003, so it wouldn't be like the first kind of resurrection of it. It's
Oh, that's just a reconstruction. I'm talking about bringing new life to it.
Oh, okay. I'm doing this project for the Barbican and for the Surrealist House exhibition, and they initially my proposal involved having a performance that would have a relationship with one of the pieces in the show, and the curator suggested that I maybe look at the Dream of Venus Pavilion, and to be honest I hadn't heard of it before, and I looked into it and I was completely amazed at how prescient it was in terms of it being a performative structure. And I don't think that there were many things like that, really, and incredibly ambitious in scale as well. The walls were these enormous fish tanks that women used to swim in and out of. But I was quite interested also in that there are like little stories that circulate around it of the performers that were interviewed for the radio, actually, for NBC, for a program called Talent from the Future. Yeah. And one of the girls, she was prompted to say all these kind of surrealist catchphrases, such as "my subconscious lives in Brooklyn" and things like that. And I kind of was interested in creating a narrative that would be centered around the actual performers and not about the pavilion as such, but possibly exploring this idea that the performer who plays Venus, that when she sleeps, she has visions of the future. And right. That would link to this footage that I shot of the actual place now. So she'd have these visions and they would appear in video form, I guess. And also I kind of like this idea that, you know, you have this beautiful event and these people and these actors and the music, and it's a completely fully immersive experience. But that actually there are these kind of invisible fictions that belong to all the characters that are in it. And I guess that's my point of interest usually in these kind of things as well.
The sort of a sort of inner narrative or a series of sort of interconnecting narratives. The thing about narratives is they tend to, I don't know, give the game away slightly. They kind of chain you to events rather than the event. And one of the things that's always struck me about your work is that it always looks incredibly glamorous. But not just that, it actually presents glamour as a kind of enigma, as almost something unknowable. I mean, how are you going to sort of, you know, what's your process in bringing that feeling into being?
Into this piece in particular?
Yeah.
I guess that I'm kind of interested in general, in cultural phenomena that has this quality of intensity to it. And that's something that I'm trying to create in my work. So they are these events that hopefully have an impact, and you know, in the best case scenario, it would be to do with the complete package, that, you know, you would listen to the soundtrack and you would get a complete experience. But I'm interested in this cheap glamour as well. And it's always like ambition over possibility, really, probability. It's just lots of people, a lot of costumes. It's very elaborate. It's like a kind of new Baroque, I guess. And I'm interested in creating an effect that can't be necessarily passed on verbally. I'm interested in an event that, if it was described in as much detail as possible, you still wouldn't be able to actually experience the full effect of it, really.
I think in the Baroque they talked about the ephemeral monument,
yeah,
which I always thought was a great notion, this combination of painting, mm-hmm, sculpture, art, performance, and cheap glamour. Mm. And we cannot use the words cheap glamour without actually bringing Richard Strange into the conversation at this point, because I think you more or less pioneered it, sir.
I knew that would be my entree, and it'll probably be written on my tombstone as well. So.
That'll be written on your tombstone. Yeah. I knew this would be my entree. Kid Strange, Richard Strange, it's a long tale, and one of the things I do associate it with is the notion of cabaret, something that is this kind of simultaneous press of people and events. Mm. What were you trying to, or what are you trying to achieve in staging a cabaret?
Well, funnily enough, the way I came about the cabaret idea in 1979, I actually opened Cabaret Futura in 1980, but I started thinking about it in 1979. My 70s band, The Doctors of Madness, had hit the buffers. You know, we were one of those bands who did three albums and left a trail of havoc and a lot of unpaid debts. And then it was time for me to move on. And it was curious listening to what you were saying about analog recording tape, because I saw that as my meal ticket in a way. I thought, who needs to tour with a band when you can tour with a Revox tape recorder and backing tapes and sound effects and cheap gimmicks on tape, which is what I did, using a Revox A77 analog reel-to-reel tape recorder, old-fashioned tape recorder, with all my musical backtracks on that. And I fashioned this into a concept album, as we used to call them, called The Phenomenal Rise of Richard Strange, in which Ludicrous, of course, I gazed into a future and saw a united Europe with a tyrannical president using advertising and corruption to smooth his way to power. Of course, it could never happen. But
I think your unconscious is in Brooklyn.
Yeah, and my conscience is in Margate, I think. So I took that on the road and took that to America, and it was fabulous traveling with this tape recorder. It didn't talk back. It didn't need a bed in a hotel room, and it always did as it was told every time I pushed the play button. And so that was what took me to America and ultimately took me to The Kitchen and P1 and those Franklin Furnace, those performance spaces in New York, which were flourishing at that time, 1978, 79. And I thought, when I came back to London, I'd love to play in places like this, but of course we don't have them, where you can get these 3, 4, 5 different performance art forms bashing up alongside of each other, creating sparks and creating a new sort of work that didn't yet have a name, but was quite interesting and quite amusing at times. And so I thought, well, when I get home, I'm going to find somewhere. And I found a rather down at heel club in Soho that had 3 people in on a Monday night. And I went in and rather grandly said to the owner, I could double your audience if you let me have it. Seeing the main chances, he said, yeah, okay, well, you take it on a 2-week basis. And, you know, if we get 12 people in here by the second week, you can keep it. And by the third week, we had 120 or something, you know, and the rest, they say, is geography. So we went on for about a year doing that and putting interesting things side by side, knocking things together, performance art, video, dance, poetry, a new art form at the time, which was called video, and of course music and spoken word, and bashed the whole thing together, and alchemically came up with a notion of Cabaret Futura.
And in a sense, it did break a lot of the barriers, which in a sense I see facilitating the kind of work that Ty's doing now. That, I mean, one of the things that's very interesting is that I think both of you, I mean, just as Cage is busy throwing out all the kind of trappings of popular culture and entertainment and what have you, you guys have actually been, you've actually sort of like taken the bare stage that he left and have actually been busy putting it all back in again. You know, I mean, I'm thinking particularly about Ty, you know, your fascination with Americana, with, you know, I always feel like I'm witnessing a sort of soap opera that involves gods and movie stars, you know, probably not at their best. and your interest as well, I noticed, in serial killers as well as kind of haunting the playhouse of the imagination.
It's not really a serial killer. It's a woman that was one of the figures that I kind of centered on for a long time, was a woman called Kitty Genovese that was killed. It's not so much the serial killer thing, but she was actually brutally murdered and kind of engendered this whole phrase called the Genovese syndrome, which is when you see a crime happen and you don't get involved. But again, it has more to do with the intensity of that moment. And I guess I'm quite interested in the dynamics of stories or events that have the possibility of becoming part of your imagination. And they're like these kind of flesh tone replay buttons that replay automatically within your mind without any kind of control of your own over them. But also, I guess my fascination with Americana definitely has to do with, you know, the American fiction and the American cinematic, of course, which I feel is part of everything in a way.
Okay, I think it's time for our second musical interlude. It's Graham Massey once again. What has he got for us this time? Thank you. This is Ken Hollings, and this is Hollingsville. And that was our second musical interlude, courtesy of Hollingsville composer-in-residence Graham Massey, and that was Fantasy on Bewitched. No drums, but it had drums. Listening to it, I suddenly realised that, in fact, that piece of music connects Eric Satie and the World Fair, because Bewitched, the series, actually started in 1964, which is the year of the 64 World Fair, and it was based on the film I Married a Witch, with Veronica Lake in the Elizabeth Montgomery role. And it was the first film directed in Hollywood by René Clair, who had just left France, where his first film, made in Paris, was Entr'acte, which had a piano Eric accompaniment Satie. Written by Eric Satie.
Of course.
For Parade.
It's all so easy when you know the answer,
yeah.
isn't it?
Yeah.
I really do enjoy being patronised on my own show. It just makes the whole experience that much more worthwhile. Now, you see, Richard, I was, you know, evidently far too young to have ever actually seen the original Cabaret Futura in the Indian restaurant around the back of Rupert Court on Sunday nights. But, I mean, give me some sense of
well, I'm under the impression that you actually played about the fourth one that we did. I remember.
Second,
you,
actually.
It was the second one, was it? Yeah, it was, you see. And they followed hard on each other in those days. They were weekly. I mean, as I sort of slither into dotage now, I can't conceive of doing more than one a month, which is what I'm about to do. But no, in those days, we did one a week with about a dozen acts or turns, as we called them, plying their wares for us. And no, you're right. You came in about the second time around and did a voice piece under the name of Capalula, as I remember.
That's right, sound poetry.
Sound poetry.
I thought I should have a completely different name to do.
What was the
like
piece? It was called The Human Voice, or No, that's the Cocteau piece, isn't it? The La Voix Humaine. But you had that.
I think it was The Human Landscape or something.
Something. Certainly nothing pretentious, Ken.
Not in the least little bit, you know. Well, I remember, you know, when I first read about it, and I thought, well, if he's, you know, if it's going to be like a sort of modernist cabaret, you should have someone doing sound poetry.
Yeah, no, absolutely, which really is why important. I booked you like a shot. Also, I knew you'd be very cheap, and only financially speaking. I mean, you've got nothing on this bit of faded glamour in terms of cheapness. But no, you were money well spent, as I recall.
What a boy will do for cab fare.
From cab fut to cab fare, yes. But I mean, topical as everything has been on this programme so far, how about this? On the first night, when we literally, the opening night, Keith Allen, actor, former stand-up comedian, father of Lily Allen, pop star, did his naked ventriloquist act using a steak and kidney pie as his dummy and doing a sort of Lord Charles and silly ass, you know, ventriloquist act. And that ventriloquist died this week. I mean, how appropriate is that?
What, the steak and kidney pudding?
No, Keith Allen. Oh. Yeah, it's missed by many. Interested? You will be.
How does this, Ty, how does this sound to you? I mean, from your experience, does this just sound like some nightmare spent in Soho? Or?
No, it sounds like a lot of fun.
It was a lot of fun. it could also be rather hazardous. Robert Fraser, the gallerist who brought all the American pop artists to
Groovy
London
Bob,
back,
yeah.
and Groovy Bob in the 50s and 60s, was an habitué, and he loved to sit at the small bar with a couple of bottles of Bollinger and a couple of boys usually, and watch the performance art. And one of our regular acts was the Event Group, who was Living Theatre performance group. And they had a very interesting take on the game of cricket for one of their pieces, which involved 22 men and women all dressed in white wielding mutant electric cricket bats that were sort of strung with bass guitar strings and very effective pickups plugged into very loud speakers. And beneath a strobe light, they would bat rather large Jaffa oranges through the club at full pelt. And I remember one hit Robert Fraser full in the mouth as he was just quaffing his Bollinger. and without missing a sip, he put it down, took off his shoe and hurled it in the rough direction of the stage and said, "Dada lives, but you will die." And at that point, he collapsed and never got his shoe back. But it was one of those great statements of early cabbie.
Mm. I get the feeling that I've always had this theory. I mean, I'm just going to try it out on both of you. That actually, the British are not very good at modernism. We tend to sort of take, you know, the grand international modernist gesture and kind of render it quaint. I mean, for example, I mean, if you look at a ballet like Facade. Edith Sitwell poems and the Bliss score and the Frederick Ashton choreography. It is just parade. Mm. It's a similar idea, a series of diversions on stage. Only, you know, it's lost all of its provocation. You know, I couldn't imagine anyone storming the stage at the first performance of Facade.
Well, it becomes their home counters, doesn't it? Facade is so home counters, it's so Gloucestershire and not London. I mean, or Sussex, you know, it's Sussex and Gloucestershire, but not really London. It's awfully jolly and very amusing. And shall we go out for dinner?
Mm.
And, you know, I think there's no, it's no surprise that Parade and Facade are almost, one is the parody of the other. You know, you've got the real thing and then you've got the ersatz. And I think Facade almost gloried in its ersatzness. You know, it was Parade as conceived by Noel Coward or something, and frightfully English and very amusing, and it wouldn't frighten the horses at all.
Mm. Do you think we're better at it now? Do you think we're better at frightening the horses, Ty?
No, I think that's one of the things I like about working in Britain, is that I don't think there is this sense of being outraged by work, and I quite like that. I think that's a positive thing, that people don't get up in arms about things that they see. But also, I don't know how possible it is to do work like that in institutions anyway, you know?
Well, that's an interesting point. I mean, you've staged works in old cinemas and works at the Horse Hospital as well, which is always a fascinating protean space. It lends itself to so many different things and yet never quite loses its own flavour, its own character. And there was something of, you know, Cabaret Futura, the Latin Quarter, the old nightclub.
Mm.
The old, good evening, ladies and gentlemen, have a wonderful evening.
Yeah. Well, don't forget what we came out of was the fag end of punk rock, which was the antithesis of all that. It was about standing up and leaping into the air. It was anti-art. It was nihilistic. It was scathing about pretension and scathing about intelligence and articulacy. Mm. And so coming in on the back of punk rock, where you had a club that, for better or worse, rather made a virtue of those things. And it was urbane, it was rather sedentary for a large part, and civilised, you know, civilised in a traditional sense, up to the point when the acts came on. And then when the acts came on, it could be mayhem with the Event Group or the Disco Winstons, who I was telling you about earlier, who performed Winston Churchill's speeches behind barbed wire and sandbags while explosions were going off under random tables and taking the legs off our clientele and off the tables, sadly. Winston Churchill's wartime speeches done against a Giorgio Moroder thumping electro beat, you know. Irresistible. How could you not love that? What's not to love, as they say?
I imagine the last few years they've just been working the cruise liners. But I mean, this is... Oh, I don't know. The description is enough. I'm sold. You know what I mean? It's like when I look at documentation of Ty's work, I'm just there.
Yeah.
I mean, if nothing else, you've produced the most wonderful, endless series, just the most glamorous looking images that actually quite often do remind me of Cocteau. I think particularly the fascination with the star. Is that?
I am very, very into Cocteau, and I reference Orfeu a lot in the work. He's a kind of character that my characters get, you know, associated with somehow. Like they say that they remind them of Orfeu or something like that. But also, I really kind of liked the imagery and the way he talks about cinema which I think that no one else really has managed to talk about as this kind of wonder machine that exists behind an invisible surface.
Mm.
And that's something that is recurrent in my work, definitely, yeah.
Well, Cocteau was total Renaissance man, wasn't he? And really made me look like an absolute sort of specialist in my field, in as much as he was a painter, a poet, a filmmaker, a metteur en scène, a facilitator, a collaborator, so on and so forth. But I must say, I think if you take one element of Cocteau's work that really he made his own, it was his filmmaking. It was the magic that he put into films, which he never quite managed to put into his artwork and never quite managed to put into his poetry.
Mm.
But, you know, his handful of great films, as Bella Lebert or Orphée or The Testament of Orphée.
Testament of Orphée. Which is amazing as well. Which is an amazing film. Yeah. As well.
And, you know, those films are so singular and so special. And even now you can watch them and be thrilled.
Absolutely.
And the way his work there has informed, like Dali to an extent, has informed so much of the vernacular that we now take for granted. You know, we don't think twice now about an arm coming through a wall holding a flaming torch or something and saying that is a torchon, you know. Mm. But you know, now you can buy one in Asda for £2, you know, and there it is. In the same way that, you know, Dali or Warhol has gone into the vernacular now, and you can buy your soup can to put on the wall, or you can buy your Dali lips sofa telephone or whatever it is. And we just take these things, you know, your melting watch or something, and that as a motif has become so much in our vernacular that we don't bat an eye anymore.
But I think didn't Duchamp once make some comment about, you know, in the future you know you'll just buy a nice bit of art to take home to the wife at the weekend, you know, it'll be something you'll do on the way home from work, and you know, a statement dripping with that kind of Northern French sarcasm of his. But it's in a sense Cocteau always manages to kind of step away from that, and I'm always reminded of an interview where he was being asked about, I think it was The Eternal Return, and there's no clear indication of the setting, and this upsets the journalist who's interviewing him, and so he's asking Cocteau, where is this film set? And Cocteau's reply is, wherever you aren't.
Curiously, with Cocteau, though, when he was being taunted, wasn't he, by principally by Diaghilev, when Cocteau was a young dandy who thought he could do everything, and wasn't it Diaghilev who said to him, étonne-moi.
Surprise me.
And curiously enough, it wasn't the film, was it?
It was Parade.
It was Parade that étonned Diaghilev. Mm. But it took a long while to come around. Funny enough, another little connection. Richard Jobson, who did the first Cabaret Futur, first night of Cabaret Futur, and many more besides, at that point styled himself totally on Jean-Marc Marais as a sort of physiognomy, and was totally besotted by Cocteau, as was Bill Nelson from Bebop Deluxe, who was another of our collaborators in at that time. So yeah, Cocteau loomed large for a lot of us back then because he was fearless. And I was seeing Alan Yentop's rather lovely, affectionate tribute to Malcolm McLaren recently. And Malcolm's on that saying, you have to be fearless about failure, otherwise you never will make great work. And Malcolm failed a lot, God rest his soul. But when he hit it, he really got it right, Malcolm, and he really pushed it on. And I think Cocteau did that to an extent. He got it wrong a lot of the time and was sycophantic and was barking up the wrong tree. But when he got it right, he was something special.
I do remember once asking you to sort of define the spirit of Cabaret Futura, and you actually said, we put the fun back into failure.
That sounds like one of mine, yeah.
And just to sort of like finish off Parade. I mean, this spectacular event in the history of modernism, which incidentally, if you talk to anyone in the actual ballet world, not interested. Yeah. I mean, they just say, oh, that's the Picasso ballet, yeah, because Picasso did the costumes and the sets. music by Satie, mise-en-scène, libretto by Coxo. If you actually read the correspondence about the creation of this piece, it's actually quite a sad narrative, because you have Cocteau initially coming up with the idea, saying, oh, you know, it's going to be great, we're going to have poems, we're going to have all these sound effects, we're going to actually have like sound-making machines in the orchestra. It'll be wonderful. And it was going to be, you know, three times the length of what it was. But what happened was that he introduced Picasso and Satie, and they got on incredibly well together. And Cocteau was driving an ambulance on the front at the time. This is still, you know, still during the Great War. And it ends up that, you know, Picasso and Satie are getting on so well, all of kind of Cocteau's ideas are slowly being thrown out, just so it becomes refined down to this one thing. Until in the end, you know, there are these plaintive notes from Jean Cocteau saying, "Are you keeping any of my sound effects?" And I go, Satie, "No, I don't like the sound effects," you know. And I think you know, the roulette wheel and the pistol shots were sort of kept under sufferance.
That wasn't the piece where someone rode a motorcycle on stage, was it?
No, that was Relâche, and Satie came on in a little electric car.
Ah, that's right. Yeah.
And Marcel Duchamp was in the nude as Adam, which is a startling thought.
Yeah.
Nude Marcel Duchamp. I think you would have to be there. So, Ty, when can we expect your piece at the Barbican?
24th of July, Saturday, 24th of July.
This will mean nothing to anyone who's listening to the podcast in weeks to come.
Yeah.
But you must tell me the title, because I love it.
It's called Last Night I Dreamt I Was Venus from Beyond the Mirrors.
I think that's such a beautiful title. Yes, it's. I took 5 minutes creating the performance and 27 hours thinking of the title. And Cabaret Futura, where, when,
yes,
why?
30 years after we closed our doors for the last time, we're opening again. For the last time. I thought, if I don't do it now, I'm not going to do it in another 30 years, that's for sure. So we open on the 21st of June at a venue in W10, Queen's Park. There's a Facebook site, Cabaret Futura, and you can find out all you need to know on there.
I do actually do a sort of follow-up post on my blog for each episode of Hollingsville, so I'll put in links to the information on Ty's piece. And
I love you, man.
That's what I'm here for, is to be loved. And that's all we ever really want, isn't it? Hey, listeners, to be loved. You have been listening to Episode 7 of Hollingsville. Events, The Birth of Chance, featured spectacular contributions from Ty Shani and Richard Strange. Musical interludes and background moods were by Hollingsville composer-in-residence Graham Massey. Opening and closing themes were by Indigo Octagon. The entire broadcast has been overseen in the studio by Hannah Brown. Tune in next week for Episode 8, Trash, The Gasp Between Clichés, when my guests will be My guest will be Roger K. Burton of the Horse Hospital and Edwin Pouncey, who will also be generating the episode interludes. This is Ken Hollings, and this has been a Project Thrust production. Project Thrust, the name you can trust.